I'll be reading from a selection of verses from the first chapter of Genesis. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be there be for signs for the seasons and for the days and years, and let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the sky, across the dome of the sky." And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them.
In the beginning, what happened? Did it go just like that? Probably not. Or was it like the other story in Genesis that follows this one, where God works a little bit each day? Now, the two stories are different. In fact, there's a couple of different versions of the beginning in our Bible. Turns out it's not actually a historical source about the beginning of all that is. Now, this probably doesn't surprise you, but I don't know. Radical things happening here at Fairview Community Church. But there are those, many of them fervent Christians, who might doubt our faith a little, who believe that everything in the Bible happened exactly as it was written, despite the fact that here, in the very first book, in the very first few chapters, we have competing stories about how it all began. Maybe that's because no one ever intended for this to be a history book. Maybe that's because this incredible, awe-filled, mysterious force that we call God intended us to use our gifts, our minds, and seek to discover, to dig deeper, to unravel the universe for the mystery that it is. Yet, unfortunately, there are people who want to keep God small, to keep the world and the universe in which it spins small, young. And in doing so, they believe that if they can keep God in a box with the story of creation, then Pandora won't slip out. But keeping God small enough to fit in your book, your box, dumbs down the human brain, desperately trying to hold down an expired theology and mythical stories, only serves to lessen the richness of humanity and enforce what I think is actually a shallow understanding of the divine. See, the Bible points us to God, but the Bible is the beginning of the journey. So here at Fairview Community Church, we celebrate Evolution Sunday as a way to affirm our belief in science, our belief that God is bigger than a book, bigger than a box. We're not afraid of what science can teach us. We're more afraid of what happens, dare we ignore it. We believe that our minds were God's gift given to us, so we do not dare check our brains at the door. We've matured beyond a mere anthropological understanding of God, and thus are not threatened by a vast universe that is so much bigger than the ancients ever fully understood. We don't really see God as a big man that lives somewhere in the clouds. And we're even ever evolving our understanding of the divine, and yet also aware of the constant presence of this mysterious force, this spirit, this stirring energy among us, with so many names, but which we simply call God. And so today we join together with congregations around the country, but as you can see, we're not the only ones that actually celebrate the day. I did say earlier, though, that we are the only ones in Orange County that celebrate this day. Are you surprised about that? Over the years, we've done this in a variety of different ways, but every time our intention is clear. We identify ourselves as progressive Christians who don't make anybody sign their name on a dotted line, recite a creed, or even share one defined theology. But we do make a pledge, I'll say it again, that we won't check our brains at the door, that we won't muffle our doubt lest we lose our faith, but we will let our questions inform and deepen our faith. We don't believe that God is so small that we could do something that could somehow undo God, or that our faith could so easily be shaken to its core that it would just disappear. It's the freedom to ask questions, to embrace science, to evolve, that allows us to experience God in new and ever transformative ways. So over the years, we've welcomed scientists of all types to take to the pulpit, each a little bit mystified about the idea that a church asked them to preach, more comfortable in a lab or a classroom, but I think usually a little bit in awe that a church would celebrate such a day as Evolution Sunday and willingly hand over their pulpit to a scientist. So if you remember, we've had a geneticist, we had a NASA comet scientist, an entomologist last year who brought bugs with them. We've engaged in all sorts of different discussions on why faith and science cannot be mutually exclusive. So today, we welcome Melinda Neiswanger, who is a PhD candidate from the University of California in Irvine, who studies ice cores, as we have now seen, and she's going to be sharing with us how they can tell us about climate change, the impact on humanity, and maybe even a little bit about what we can do besides just educating ourselves to help fix some of the damage that human beings have made. So from the little I've already gleaned, I am confident that this is going to be a fascinating morning. So now I'll shut up, and you can join me in welcoming Melinda Neiswanger.
So I'm a little tall, so I'll have to move this up, sorry. So thanks for inviting me. I'm really excited to talk to you guys. I am from Texas, so I might say y'all a little bit. Just bear with me, I know Californians hate that. So if you could just click, I'll give you like a thumbs up when I'm ready. So I'm gonna talk to you today about ice core science. So you've all just seen what an ice core sample looks like. Ice cores are, first about me. I'm in my fifth year of the PhD program in the Department of Earth System Science at UC Irvine. And that department is actually the first of its kind in the United States. And President Obama, when he came to UCI a few years ago to give the commencement speech, mentioned that. And it integrates, it integrates both the land, the ocean, and the atmosphere as one unity. Because you can't just look at the ocean and infer what's happening with climate change or with humans' influence. You have to look at everything, because when you do something on land, it also impacts the atmosphere and impacts the oceans. So that's kind of what my program is trying to figure out, is how have humans changed the climate system? My background is in meteorology, so I went from studying the weather to studying climate, pretty much sort of the same thing. And the biggest thing I think that I've accomplished in my life is I've gone to the South Pole 2 times. I've lived there for about 4 months. Total. So that was fun. And if I have time, I'll show some pictures from that. So to begin with, what is an ice core? So you all just saw a small bit of an ice core, so just fragments of leftover samples from our lab. But ice cores are these big cylinders that we drill from the ice sheets. So the two main ice sheets on Earth are Antarctica and Greenland. Okay, and Antarctica has had ice for at least a few million years. But our oldest ice cores that we have, that we've done gas analysis on, are about 800,000 years old. So the Earth is older than 6,000 years old, and we can easily see that with our ice core samples. And what's really cool about Antarctica and Greenland is the snow that falls each year is going to be preserved, because up until recently, the temperatures over these places have always been below freezing, even in the summer months. And so you preserve that snowfall year after year. It turns to ice, and we can drill these ice cores. So what I'm showing you here is an ice core from the West Antarctic ice sheet. That core went back to about 3,400 meters in depth, so that's like 2 miles. And it gave us about 70,000 years of records. And you can actually see in there, does anyone want to guess what that black mark is without reading the caption? It is a volcanic eruption. So anything that goes into the atmosphere eventually comes out. And so these big volcanic eruptions, the ash will make its way to Antarctica and Greenland and get preserved in the ice. So this one was from about 21,000 years ago. And so ice formation in polar areas is a lot different than ice that you form in your freezer. So as you saw already, there's those really cool air bubbles. And the reason for that is because ice in Antarctica and Greenland and over glaciers in the mountain areas forms because of time rather than temperature. So it's always very cold in these places, so the precipitation that falls is mostly always going to be snow. And if you've ever thrown a snowball, I don't know, I'm talking to Southern Californians, at at people, you know that if you compress it and really pack it tight, it's going to hurt. And the same thing happens over these polar areas, where year after year the snow falls, and in the beginning at that upper portion of the ice sheet, it's very fluffy, very light snow. But as you move further down, and this picture is depicting the top of the snow going down into the ice sheet, that snow compresses. And as it compresses, you start to trap air bubbles. And so what you saw is an actual ice portion of the ice sheet where those air bubbles have been preserved and locked in with that ice. So as it ages, the air ages with the ice. Okay? And snow contains more than just water. It actually has particles and different chemicals that we can analyze and see how different things changed in time. So a lot of the things we look for are what we call organic acids. And those things come from trees and oceans, and you can actually measure that stuff and see how things change. So there's a lot of measurements we make. And of course, ice contains air bubbles, and that's what I study. So how are ice cores drilled? So this is a video that I took at the South Pole. So if you want to hit play, I'll kind of talk about what's going on. So right now we're pulling up the drill out of the ice sheet. So we are at the South Pole here. Temperature outside is about minus 20 degrees Celsius. And the drill is now coming up out of what we call the borehole. We had been drilling for a few months already, so we were at about 700 meters depth. And so the ice core drill goes down into the borehole. It rotates. It has very sharp cutters on the edge. It digs into the ice, and it slowly drills out a cylinder of ice. And then we pull that drill back up. It's on a cable. And so you can imagine if you're going 700 meters down into the ice sheet, it takes quite a long time, about an hour or so, to pull that drill up. And then you can tilt it back. And inside that barrel right now is a 2 meter or about 6 foot long piece of ice. And you can kind of see my camera did not want to focus. It's minus 20 degrees outside. Batteries don't do well in cold. And so they're putting a protective cover on that because those blades are incredibly sharp. And they're going to pull that barrel out, and that barrel has the 2 meters of ice. And so you do this process multiple times. This core that we drilled went to 1,750 meters, and you pull 2 meters at a time. So you can do the math. You have to go down 800 plus times. And each time, you know, it goes from, in the beginning, a few minutes to drill to several hours. So it takes quite a long time. And so they're pulling that out. These are engineers, not ice core scientists, so they don't really necessarily care about what happens to the ice, but I do, so I'll push that ice out, and then I package it up, and it gets shipped back to the United States. So this was a United States-funded project, so it's stored in Denver, Colorado. Okay. And so a lot of times people say, well, how do you know how old the ice is? I told you that ice was 3,000 years old. I wasn't lying. One way you can do that is through layer counting. So if you've ever seen a tree core, you've seen these tree rings, right? And the same thing happens in ice. So the snow that falls in winter versus snow that falls in summer has different chemicals in it because the moisture is coming from different places and it's going to have those properties going along with it. And so you can actually see the layers. So this picture on top is a picture of a core. Basically, they scan it with a scanner. And then the picture on the bottom is one I actually took myself of just an ice core sample that we were taking. And you can see those layers. So if you count a winter layer and a summer layer, that's 1 year. So you can actually count all the way back in time. Thank God that's not my job. All right, so next, and then the other way you can do it is with volcanic layers. So we have a lot of historical records of these big volcanic eruptions, and you can actually see visible ash layers in the cores, and so you can use those to help date the core too. So again, this picture on the left is the one I showed you earlier, and then on the right is one that I got to see firsthand in the ice core. We pulled it out of the barrel, and there was this black band right there. It's kind of faint compared to the other one, but it was a volcanic eruption that happened around Antarctica about 3,500 years ago. It's pretty cool. Next, please. And so there's also a lot of volcanic eruptions that occur that you can't actually see the ash layer. And so when these volcanic eruptions occur, a lot of stuff goes into the atmosphere, particularly sulfur dioxide, and that actually what it does is it acidifies the atmosphere. And so for a period in time, for about a year or so after a big volcanic eruption, you're going to have a more acidic atmosphere. And so you can actually run electricity across the ice core. And when you hit a period of acidity in the core, you're actually going to get a peak in that electrical measurement. So if you can push play, the picture on the left or right is actually a video. Maybe it'll work. Yeah. So this is the ice core. It's cut it open on its, like, in the half. And they're actually, it's hard to see, but they're running little electrodes along the top of the core. So this is a non-destructive method for us to date the core, right? You're just measuring electricity. It's not destroying the core. And then you end up with a readout on the bottom left. And you can see that peak in the electricity is where there's a volcano. And so you get these peaks. And there's actually quite a lot of volcanic eruptions. One of the many measurements we make. And you can go ahead. And these are some other measurements we make in ice cores. I'm not going to go through all of them, mainly because I don't know how to explain some of them. And the big one, though, I've already talked about ash layers and, electrical conductivity. A lot of people actually study biology, so people can study bacteria. So talking about evolution, we have 800,000 years of records, you can actually study the evolution of bacteria that gets stuck in the ice over time. So that's pretty cool. But what I'm going to focus on today are gases, mainly carbon dioxide and methane, because these are really important right now, considering what's going on in our environment. So briefly, a greenhouse gas. So I'm sure many of you have been in a greenhouse before, and you know they're really warm. And the reason for that is the energy that's coming from the sun is in what we call short waves. It's very high energy, so it has a short wavelength. So the sun is obviously very warm in comparison to the Earth. Okay, but the Earth is going to re-emit energy back to space in a less energetic form, so we call that a long-wave energy. But greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, they can't absorb shortwave. Basically, the shortwave energy just goes right through them because they don't have the right properties to do so, to do that absorption. But they can really efficiently absorb long-wave energy. So if you imagine you have methane and carbon dioxide hanging out in our atmosphere, if you start putting more of those gases into the atmosphere, they're going to start trapping and absorbing more outgoing energy. So the analogy I make a lot is it's like putting blankets on at night when it's cold, and you put 10 blankets on, but then you wake up in the middle of the night and you're really sweaty. And that's because you're putting more of these gases, more of these blankets, that can trap that outgoing energy. And that's actually what's going on right now. But I also want to emphasize that greenhouse gases are not bad entirely. Because without a greenhouse layer in our atmosphere, the Earth would not be habitable. Actually, the temperature of the Earth without a set amount of carbon dioxide and methane would be well below freezing. So we'd be an icy Earth. So we do need some amount of carbon dioxide and methane, but what I'll show you in a minute proves that we have way too much right now. Okay. So this is an ice core plot, so I'm going to go through it very slowly. What I want to show you here on the bottom is time. So on the right, year zero is 1950. We use 1950 because that's when we started the nuclear bomb testing. So 1950 is zero. Okay. And as you go back onto the left side, you're going back in time in the units of thousands of years before present. So zero is 1950, going back to 800,000 years ago. Okay. And so then in blue is our carbon dioxide levels. Okay. And atmospheric scientists use the unit of measurement called parts per million, which means for every million molecules of air, you're looking at between 180 or 300 molecules of carbon dioxide. So very tiny amounts of these gases, but we know that they're very important in regulating our planet's temperature. And then on the bottom in red, the same thing, but for methane. And so methane is actually measured in parts per billion. So for every billion molecules of air, there's 300 to 800 molecules of methane. So much less abundant, but methane is actually a more powerful greenhouse gas. So there's a lot of things going on in our atmosphere. So what I want to point out is if you go back to about 20,000 years ago, you can see that both methane in red and carbon dioxide in blue are really low. Does anyone know what happened 20,000 years ago? Yeah, Ice Age. We've seen the movie, right? Right, so 20,000 years ago, it was the last ice age. Temperatures on Earth were significantly colder, and we can see from our ice core records, those measurements made of those air bubbles, that carbon dioxide was about 180 parts per million, and methane was about 350 parts per billion. And then if we go back another about 100,000 years, so now you're about 120,000 years ago, you can see that CO2 and methane were high again. And that's actually the timing of our last interglacial period, our last warm period. And so, if you click one more time, this is the whole record of methane and carbon dioxide over the last 800,000 years. And does anything strike you from these plots? Is there anything obviously happening? Yeah, there's cycles. And those cycles are due to the Earth's orbit. So a lot of times, climate skeptics, deniers, always bring into the fact that the Earth's orbit changes. Yeah, we know the Earth's orbit's changed. And we can see that because when the Earth's orbit changes, you get more direct sunlight in certain places on Earth, and that's going to start causing these changes to occur. But we actually do put Earth's orbit changes into our climate models, so that's not a good excuse for not believing in climate change. but we can see that this happens about every 100,000 years, and it makes sense based on what we know on Earth's orbit cycles. And so you can basically see that for CO2, the maximum we ever have seen in the ice cores is about 300 parts per million. Okay, so keep that number in mind as we go on. Okay, so you can change the slide. So this is modern measurements of atmospheric carbon dioxide, and these have been made since 1958 over Mauna Loa, Hawaii. They're now made in many parts of the world, and this is from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who is a federal entity, so when the government shuts down, they also have to shut down. But they're making these measurements all over the world. And what you can notice, so going from 1958, this is the most recent plot I could find, up until December 2017, it's a pretty strong increasing trend, right? You can see that that carbon dioxide level is increasing. And what you can also see, so the black line is the yearly average, and the red line wiggles up and down. Does anyone want to guess why the wiggling happens? It is the seasons. So just like you and I breathe in and out, the Earth breathes in and out too. So during the summer season when there's a lot of trees growing, they're breathing in a lot of CO2. But then in the winter when the leaves fall and the trees start to go into, I guess, hibernation, you don't have as much CO2 uptake. Okay, and so you actually have these wiggles, and that's the seasonal cycle. But if you plot a line through it, which is the black line, it's still an increasing trend. Okay. And so in December of 2017, the atmospheric CO2 level over Mauna Loa was 406 parts per million. Okay. So if you compare that to the ice core record, so this is the same record I just showed you, 800,000 years. The scale is in minus years, but still the same idea. You can see that for the whole record of ice core, our ice core history, we've never seen carbon dioxide as high as it is today. And if we continue putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere with our activities, which is from burning of fossil fuels, all that kind of stuff, if you hit one more time, by the end of this century, we're expected to be near 900 parts per million. So that's 2100, just about 80 years from now. And this is from climate models, and so far our climate models have been pretty much correct. The only thing that we struggle with our climate models is how much are humans going to change the environment. And right, humans are very uncertain people. So if you continue, kind of what should we do? Many of you probably are familiar with CFCs, right? okay? And CFCs, it's actually a really interesting thing because the discovery of CFCs and how they contributed to, does anyone know what this is I'm showing? The ozone hole, okay, over Antarctica. So the scientists who discovered that ozone was being depleted by these chlorofluorocarbons, abbreviated CFCs, was Sherry Rowland from UC Irvine. And he got a Nobel Prize along with his colleague back in the mid-90s for this discovery. Was it? Yeah, the mid-90s. They had actually discovered this was happening much earlier in the 70s. But surprisingly, there's a lot of people invested in producing CFCs. And so there was a lot of political drama regarding how are we going to stop producing CFCs. Okay, so if you click one more time, it's encouraging because actually we figured something out and we're able to stop producing and using these CFCs that were destroying the ozone layer. And so this was an article from the Washington Post earlier last year, that the ozone hole is shrinking and it's the smallest it's been since 1988. There's still a hole there, so don't get confused, but it is now getting smaller over time, which is good. And the reason for that, if you go to the next slide, is that we introduced this Montreal Protocol. So this was a treaty signed by many countries in 1987. And just for reference, I got this plot from Ben and Jerry's website. So Ben and Jerry's are very much invested in climate change because ice cream will melt when temperatures get warm. That's their little motto. And so what it's showing is if we did not enact the Montreal Protocol, which reduced the chlorine atoms, so the chlorofluorocarbons, they call them chlorine atoms, that would be the orange bars going forward. So this only goes to 2030. So you can see how much more chlorine, how much chlorofluorocarbons we would have in the atmosphere. But with that Montreal Protocol, we have the blue bars, so significantly less, and they phase out. So CFCs have a long lifetime in the atmosphere. They can live for about 100 years before they're destroyed. So anything we do today will still impact the atmosphere 100 years from now with CFCs. For the most part, they're banned everywhere, although, you know, some people don't abide by rules. But what I'm trying to say here is that we can, if we want, make a difference in the CO2 and the greenhouse gas issue. The problem is not if the science is clear. The science is obviously clear. The problem is getting people to actually do something about it because there are a lot of people invested in these companies, oil and gas, that want to make money still. And obviously, you don't want people to go without jobs, so we have to work together to figure out how to do that. So if you go to the next slide, I am a scientist, not a politician. I'm not an engineer either. So my basic thing to tell people is that we need to be good stewards of our Earth, right? I don't have any children yet, but I do want to have children eventually. And I want them to live in an Earth and a planet that is clean and it's not polluted and they can breathe and they're not dealing with the issues of temperatures being so warm that they can't go outside or that the sea level has risen so much that all of the oceans that we knew or all the places that we used to go to are now not manageable. So the first thing that I always tell people is to vote and be incredibly informed. So Orange County was unique last year, and they voted in a different way than they usually do. But the thing is I cannot make policies, and I cannot enact Montreal protocols. So we need people that will do those for us and actually want to listen to what we have to say and educate others. So one thing I've learned is that you can't just tell people, yeah, the climate is changing. You have to reach them on a common ground. And I usually say, do you have children or do you have grandchildren? And do you want them to live in a world that is so hot or so polluted that they can't enjoy it? And they usually get kind of teary-eyed. and be a conscious consumer. Obviously, not everyone can afford Teslas. I most certainly cannot on my graduate stipend. But I also carpool and bike and walk as much as I can to reduce my carbon footprint. And this actually up here on the right is a study that came out last year about the ways in which you can reduce your carbon footprint. And the number one, the top one, that has the most significant impact, which was quite controversial, was have one fewer child. And so obviously you can't tell people how to live their lives, but if you think about how much a person, a human, impacts the environment, having one fewer person will definitely reduce that carbon footprint. But beneath that is a live a car-free life. Avoid flying, buy green energy, buy a more efficient car, et cetera, et cetera. And also one that's pretty important is eat a plant-based diet. So eating meat is actually really hard on the environment. And I would say I'm about 90% vegetarian. I am from Texas, so I really do enjoy steak. And so one thing that I always think about and I tell people is one of these Native American proverbs is that we don't inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. So that's basically all I have to say about climate change. I have some pictures from my trip to Antarctica. I don't want to make you guys stay later if you don't want to, but if you want to see them, I'm more than happy to go through them. So do you want to see them? Okay. All right, so if you click... So this is really quickly what we do at UCI. So when I said we measure carbon dioxide, methane, those are parts per million, parts per billion levels. At UC Irvine, we measure parts per trillion levels of gases in those air bubbles. So very, very tiny amounts. And if you click one more slide, and you might be able to play, this is a video, of how we get the air bubbles out. So it's kind of hard to see, but I basically break the ice apart in a chamber, and then I melt it. And so the air bubbles, you can actually see coming out in the water there. Yeah. So I do this. I can measure about 2 samples a day. So not a very efficient process, but it's pretty cool. I get very mesmerized by watching bubbles. And so you can click to the next slide. And so my research really focuses on what we call hydrocarbons. So hydrogen and carbon bonded together. The most common hydrocarbon is methane, C with 4 hydrogens. And so I measure ethane, which is very similar to methane, but a little different. And so here's some of my data from Greenland. And so the little gray dots are ice core measurements of ethane, and the time period is calendar year. So we're looking at from about 1400 up to modern day. So that's like medieval period. And the blue line is the ethane level over Greenland today. So you can see how much we've changed. And the reason we look at Greenland versus Antarctica is there's more people, more land in the Northern Hemisphere. So the impact, the amount of change you're going to see over Greenland is going to be much greater than over Antarctica. So that's kind of what I do. So if you can click one more. So the United States has 3 stations in Antarctica that are always maintained. So you have number 1, which is Palmer Station, which has all the pretty penguins. It's super beautiful. Then number 2 is the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station, which is where I was. And then number 3 is McMurdo Station, which is another coastal station. So if you click. To get to Antarctica, it took a little bit of time. I flew from LAX, which is not my favorite airport, to Sydney, Australia. So that's a 14-hour nonstop flight. From Sydney, you fly to Christchurch, New Zealand, which is the headquarters, one of the headquarters for the U.S. Antarctic Program. And that flight's like 4 hours. And then from Christchurch, you fly U.S. Air Force into Antarctica. And that flight can range anywhere between, 5 to 8 hours, depending on what aircraft you fly. And then from Christchurch, or so from McMurdo Station, you then fly into South Pole. So the only way to get to South Pole Station is through airplane. And so if you click next, this is what it kind of looks like when you get to Christchurch, New Zealand. They won't let you go to Antarctica unless you have the right gear. We call that the extreme cold weather gear. So temperatures at South Pole Station can fluctuate between -12, -10 degrees Fahrenheit to -60 degrees Fahrenheit in just a day. So you have to have the right gear. So here I am. This is like a room with all of these goose jackets, like down jackets. They're incredibly warm, but also pretty heavy. So you can kind of make me out underneath that jacket. Each of these jackets is really expensive, but obviously you need them in order to not get cold and die in Antarctica. So if you go to the next one, and this is how you get there. So I flew on a C-17, which was pretty phenomenal. And you fly with cargo. So it's not just like a commercial jet where you have, you know, movies and whatnot. You line up and you sit next to people in these bucket seats. And my first trip down to Antarctica was really cool because they had to load something at the end, and they wouldn't really tell us what they were loading. And they're like, we have to move over here to load one more package. And I was like, okay, whatever. And all the way at the end, if you can see, there's like a gray shipping container. That shipping container had dynamite on it. And so they take dynamite to Antarctica because they want to, they're called crevasses, where the glaciers are moving and they open up. And unfortunately, people have, you know, hurt themselves or even died by falling into these, especially people that like climb through glaciers. And so what they'll do in Antarctica is they have to keep these things at bay, so they actually blow them up and then they collapse in on themselves. So they loaded that at the end in case something happened and we'd have to like let it off over the ocean. So that was fun. If you go next. And this is my first view from Antarctica, from the C-17. I was able to go up into the cockpit. And I forgot to put my glasses on, my sunglasses, and that was a big mistake because it's white and incredibly bright, but spectacular. And so go ahead. And so these are some of the pictures of me. So this is McMurdo Station. In the background is sea ice. So during the winter time, the ocean freezes and you form sea ice. And that actually doubles the size of Antarctica during the winter months. And here I am next to one of the big, what they call people movers. Is the airport or the runway is a little bit off. It's about an hour commute away from the station. And so you have to ride in these like tractors. I'm 5'7" and I'm standing next to that tire. So so interesting changes to regular equipment and machinery to make it in these cold places. So go ahead and next. And so then I flew to South Pole, but I flew on a C-130 Hercules. So these are old military planes that have been retrofitted with skis. So there are not brakes on this plane. So you land and you kind of coast to a stop, which is always fun. And in not very posh conditions either. So you're all like kind of squished together, very loud. They're not insulated, so you have to wear earplugs. But definitely a really cool experience. Okay. You can go. I'll go fast. Okay. And this is my first view of, well, I didn't take this picture, but I wish. And this is the view of South Pole, an aerial view. And so if you look over to the right, you see that cluster of like buildings and kind of disturbances. That's the actual South Pole station. And then you can see a few other little buildings kind of up to the left a little bit. And those are other scientific projects that happen. So there's the South Pole telescope. They measure cosmic ray background, a lot of physics stuff that I cannot explain. But really cool stuff going on down at South Pole. And that little, you can't even see it on this projector, but there's a little speck, and that was our ice core drilling site that we had to build ourselves. So when we first got there in 2014, it was just flat ice sheet, and then we built all of this up. So just some more pictures. The South Pole Station just turned 10 years old, I think. Yeah, they built this. It took many, many summer months to build, many years in a row, because they can only be out there working in the summer. But it's heated, like one entity. It's cool. There's a gym and a cafeteria and all types of stuff. Here I am at the International Passenger Terminal. There was not security. it was pretty cool. Yeah. And so just kind of the dorm, it's like dorm style. Every person has their own little room, but little room. Not much room in there to do anything except get dressed and sleep. Keep going. And then just some of the activities we do. So I was there for 3 months, starting in early November, and I stayed through early February. So I was there for Thanksgiving and Christmas, New Year's. My birthday's also around Christmas. And so on Christmas Day, they do the race around the world, which is really neat, because at the bottom of the earth, you can just kind of run around and race around the world. it was actually a one and a half mile race outside. And I forgot to mention that the elevation of South Pole is about 9,000 feet. The physiological elevation, what it feels like on your body, is more like 10 to 11,000 feet. So I started running, and I maybe lasted 2 minutes. incredibly hard to breathe, and it's really dry and really cold air. But so some of these pictures, the picture on the left is our ice core drilling team. This is a significant amount of the South Pole Station out on the Race Around the World Day. There's about 150 people at the South Pole Station at any given time. And there I am on the top right. And that picture, of all the pictures they could have chosen, that picture got put on the UCI homepage for like 2 weeks. And it was, I'm wearing Grinch pajama pants, okay? Anyways, so yeah. And this is kind of what we would look at every day to see like what the temperature was, what the conditions were. The temperature was minus 26 degrees Fahrenheit with a wind chill of minus 50, so a little colder than today. And for reference, the barometer was 10,300 feet that day. And it could fluctuate 1,000 feet any given day based on the weather patterns moving in. And keep going. And this is our internet. So the green is when we had internet. And then the remainder of the day, we had no internet. All of the internet down at South Pole is based on satellite coverage. Well, it's a pole. It's at the bottom of the Earth. So the satellites don't necessarily hit that often. And the GO satellite was a weather satellite launched in the 1970s that has now been decommissioned. It actually just kind of stopped working last year. So, but yeah, so needless to say, it was not on Facebook or, you know, Twitter or anything. And some of the fun things we got to do, I helped make pies for Thanksgiving. So there's 150 people that you serve, like, a real Thanksgiving dinner to. So the cooks asked for help, so I was baking pies. Yeah. And one thing you'll also notice is that there's not a lot of women there. There's 150 people. I would say maybe 15 to 20 were women. So yeah, rock on. Okay. Keep going. And so this is like, I was there for two seasons, so I had two Thanksgiving dinners. And you know, you gotta take a picture of your Thanksgiving dinner when you're at the South Pole. So yeah, it was pretty good. Wasn't my mom's food, but that's okay. Keep going. They have it all shipped in. Yeah. All of the food at South Pole is frozen, as you can, as you would imagine. So they have to thaw. I mean, turkeys usually are frozen, right? But they have to thaw them out. Yeah, and so one thing, if you've ever been skiing or been in very cold environments, you know that you have to eat a lot. Your body is a little engine, and so you have to consume a lot of calories to stay warm. So they estimate that when you're working outside for 8 hours a day in these temperatures, you need to consume between 5,000 to 7,000 calories a day. Which is very hard when you're used to eating a Southern California diet. And so we would consume Clif Bars and Luna Bars. You know, there's Snickers and Toblerones, Three Musketeers, Tim Tams. If you've never had a Tim Tam, yeah, Tim Tams. And Oreos. Yeah, and so lots and lots of snacks. Yeah, so just some of the food. I mean, constantly eating. So whenever I got back, a lot of people were like, well, what was the hardest thing? I was like, eating. And they're like, really? I was like, you have to eat every 10 minutes, basically, or else you just get so cold. And keep going. Here's just some more pictures. We had a little Christmas party, and I sent that to my mom. And just some of like the little weird things that people do there. So this is a Twin Otter airplane. I don't know if you know, about 2 years ago, well, so it had been 2016, there was a rescue at the South Pole. I don't know if you heard about this, where they had to rescue two people in pretty much the dead of winter, and that's the plane they took. There's actually a really cool video, if you look online, of the two pilots. It was just two pilots, and they put a GoPro, and they showed them landing. And the way they landed, they lit up the runway by burning fuel in barrels. And it's really cool to watch them coming in, and you can hear the music they were playing. I mean, what type of daredevils fly to South Pole? You know, crazy. Anyway, so keep going. My selfie at the South Pole, it's my favorite picture. And I celebrated my birthday there. So it was a really cool experience. And if you keep going, so I don't want to take too much time. These are some of the vehicles we have. So a lot of them are just regular vehicles that they've fitted to be in cold environments. And so the reason I went, so the actual science purpose, was to drill the South Pole Ice Core, which we abbreviated to Spice Core. So the joke is, I'm a Spice Girl. And there's always questions of which one I am, but it ended up being 1,751 meters deep, and it gives about 50,000 years of climate records. And the reason we drilled at South Pole is it's so cold there that it preserves the gases that are in those air bubbles. So there's obviously some scientific reasons to drill at different places. And so here I am with some of the cores. So my job as the core handler was to get the core once it came out of the barrel, measure it, because we need to know how deep we are in order to know how old we are, and then package it up to get shipped back to the United States. So if you keep going, here I am. So we package them up in 1 meter long tubes, and they get put in these boxes. Five tubes get put in one box. And then if you keep going, we palletize those up, and they get put, one more, on an Air Force pallet, and they get shipped out on a boat. They actually leave Antarctica on a boat in a refrigerated container kept at minus 30 degrees Celsius. And then they end up in Port Hueneme, up north of LA. And then they get offloaded and shipped to, next slide, the National Ice Core Lab, which is in Denver, Colorado. And if you're ever in Denver, I encourage you to go there. It's just a huge freezer with all of the United States ice cores lined up in a freezer. So pretty cool. And yeah, that's me in the freezer collecting samples. And next one. And I always get asked if I saw a penguin, and I did. I hope you can see him. There he is. Yeah. Very good. And then next slide. I think that's it. So thanks for inviting me, and I hope I helped something.